Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. With the July 4th holiday only a week away, many Americans are beginning once again to reflect upon the founding of our nation and what relevance the events that occurred two centuries ago have for us in today's world. In recent decades, a debate has arisen both in academic circles and amongst the general public as to whether the United States was founded as a Christian nation. This debate is not merely an intellectual exercise brought up for the mere enjoyment of argument, but it actually has significant impact on public policy and judicial decisions that affect the daily lives of citizens, from whether children can pray in public schools to whether or not the government can fund religious charities without violating the First Amendment. To help us get a handle on this debate, I am pleased to be joined by John Fia, Associate Professor and Chair of the History Department at Messiah College in Grantham, Pennsylvania. He is the author of numerous articles, opinion pieces, and several books, including The Way of Improvement Leads Home, Philip Vickers Fithian and the Rural Enlightenment in Early America, and Was America Founded as a Christian Nation? A Historical Introduction. The latter book is the topic of today's discussion, and you can find more information about that book and Professor Fia's other articles and op-eds via the links that we have posted to them on our website. John, it's good to have you on Research on Religion.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tony.
All right, let's get right to the chase here. So the question to you is, was America founded as a Christian nation, yes or no?
Yeah, if I had, what is it saying, if I had a dime for every time I've been asked that question, I would argue that it depends. How's that for an academic speech?
Well, yeah, I know. I was hoping for a quick yes or no, and then I could, you know, cut the interview and get out there and mow my lawn and things like that. But I guess we're going to have to continue on with the discussion here.
Yeah.
So, what do you mean by it depends?
Yeah, in some ways, you know, the title of my book is a bad historical question, mm-hmm. Because it presumes an easy yes or no answer. And approaching this as a historian, and I'm trying to, you know, approach this question, again, the subtitle of my book is A Historical Introduction. The past is much more complex and much more nuanced than simply yes or no answers. You know, there's a huge conversation about this today. It's largely driven by politics, mm-hmm. or some type of present-day ideological agenda. So what you do is you find a lot of pundits and politicians going into the past, if you want to call it cherry picking. The historian Bernard Balin called it indoctrination by historical example. You know, where you go into the past, you look for something useful to promote your sort of agenda in the present, and whatever's not useful is really irrelevant to the kind of point that you're trying to make. So we're all looking for a usable past, and sometimes that creates difficulty in sort of nailing down, or at least making sense of, I should say, the nuances and complexities of the past. So I'm trying to get away from, you know, this kind of law school history where, a lawyer, if you're a criminal lawyer, right, you go into the past, you're not interested in the context or the complexity of the past. You want to find a case that's going to get your client off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're not really interested in how that case fits into the larger sort of context of legal history in the decade that it was decided or so forth. So that's what I'm trying to get at. So this question, was America founded as a Christian nation? A lot of it depends on, how you're going to define your terms, or what do you mean by Christian? What do you mean by nation? And I try to play around with some of those definitional issues a little bit in the book.
Well, let's talk about that definitional issue, because that Christian nation, that's really a loaded term. You know, what do we mean by Christian nation?
Yeah, it's depending on how you define that term, and it's been defined historically in American history in a variety of different ways. So, you know, I try to argue in the first four chapters of my book that, for the most part, Americans, whether they've been honestly interpreting or correctly interpreting the founders, Americans have always believed that they have been part of a Christian nation. Now, normally, when they talk about being part of a Christian nation, and I should add, this is not even a contested topic, say, in the 19th century. I mean, everybody just assumed that, you know, America was not a Buddhist nation or a Muslim nation or a secular nation or a Jewish nation. It was a Christian nation largely because the population of the population was largely identified in one way or another with the Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, there's other ways of thinking about it as well. I mean, someone like, say, William Lloyd Garrison, who was an abolitionist in the 19th century, probably one of the more famous of the abolitionists, you know, really despised the idea of America being a Christian nation, because how can a Christian nation allow slavery, for example, to be embedded in the United States Constitution? You know, he wanted to burn the Constitution as a result because it allowed slavery. Now, he was taking a view of a Christian nation that was much more driven by, you know, orthopraxy, right?
Right.
How a nation behaves. Does a nation's laws and policies reflect, say, the teachings of Jesus Christ? You know, there's others who have looked, and this is very popular today, actually. You look at the founding fathers and, you know, were they Orthodox Christians? And then there's this logical jump that's often made, you know, just because they were Orthodox Christians means, you know, that they would have wanted to establish some type of a Christian nation. And then there's another argument that you see quite often, in which you define Christian nation as a sort of ethos, or, you know, the founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and so forth, the general culture of the time was sort of deeply Christian, and as a result, these documents have somehow been informed by a Christian view of natural rights or something to that effect. So, you know, depending on how you're going to define the term, you know, you're going to come up with a different answer to the question in the title of my book. So I think it's important to think about not only how we define those terms when we debate this issue today, you know, in the press or on cable news or whatever, but also to think about the ways in which the founders sort of understood or did not understand their nation to be uniquely Christian.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And I want to point out to our readers that in the first three or four chapters of your book, you actually do a history of the history of this idea, which
right.
I thought it was a very interesting beginning of the book. You know, typically, we think of historians explaining everything chronologically. You start with point A and you end it with point Z and you go through B, C, D, et cetera. But you start out with this history of the idea. And I'm not going to talk about that too much today. I want our listeners to go ahead and pick that up on the book. We got to leave them with some teaser here for them to purchase the book and such. What you were talking about here, the history of that idea and how we define that term Christian nation is somewhat important. I'm anticipating a fairly lively conversation here, since when I read your book, I was skeptical on some of the points. However, I do think you make some convincing arguments on other points. So for your sake and for our listeners here, I think I'm going to go ahead and lay my cards out
sure.
on the table and see what you happen to think about. This
sure.
is my understanding of the whole debate. You know, first of all, I'm not of the ilk to say that the British American colonies or, you know, subsequently the United States was created on Christian nationalism per se, that this wasn't, okay, we are going to be a Christian nation just the way perhaps Israel is a Jewish nation. I'm not of that understanding. Now, I do understand that the Pilgrims and the Puritans in the early to mid 17th century certainly did come to establish their own brand of Christianity, basically free from Anglican harassment. But I also fully acknowledge that the primary motives for colonization beyond the Puritans were largely economic in nature, as I note
right.
in my own book, The Political Origins of Religious Liberty, and by mentioning that book, now I can link it on our website as well. Anyways, you know, basically, if you take a look at the context of the time, and, you know, you mentioned the issue of context being very important here, you know, America was a great place to improve your living standard if you weren't in the British aristocracy. And not surprisingly, this attracts a type of individual, basically a transient, pioneering, motivated individual that sociologists really know to be not the churchy or church-going type. And you think about who would come over to America's in the 1670s or 1680s. It's basically young, single males, pioneering guys that today might be involved in extreme sports. And if you take a look around, you know, Sunday in the pews, that's not the people you typically find in church, right? So yeah, that's a lot of the culture of the time. And I think that's a point that a lot of us oftentimes forget, that everybody came over here was very pious in that regard. Now, on the other hand, I do believe that the congregational, and I mean small c, not the denomination, congregational style of Protestantism that flourished in the colonies from the actual Congregationalist, big C, proper noun in New England, to the Quakers in Pennsylvania, and then later on to the Methodists and Baptists that spread during the Great Awakening, they had a huge impact on creating, I think, an individualistic and democratic ethos that set the cultural stage for the Revolution, as well as the drafting of the Articles of Confederation, the Northwest Ordinance, the Constitution, and a number of founding documents here. And in terms of the influences surrounding the drafting and passage of these documents, again, I fully acknowledge there's really strong economic and political motivations at play. But it was really set in an environment that glowed strongly with, we call it the background radiation of Calvinistic thought. And so if I had to answer this question, is America a Christian nation? My bottom line would be basically, no, the U.S. was not established as a Christian nation per se, but yes, it was indirectly influenced, if in a not so insignificant way, by congregational and Calvinistic culture. What's your thoughts on that statement?
Yeah, I appreciate you laying that out. And I have to confess, I have not read your book, but it is now on my reading list.
All right, very good. I think it's 25% off at Amazon right now. So.
But thanks for summarizing. So I'm not sure how you actually flesh that argument out, and I'm eager to see how you do. My initial reaction to this would be, in one sense, I think we'd be hard-pressed. I think we're in agreement on the fact that much of 18th century and 17th century culture was driven by Christian ideas, and maybe even I would agree, even Calvinist ideas. Even in Jamestown and Virginia, where historians normally associate the founding of that colony, and I do to some extent in my book, with sort of economic motivations, maybe even at its worst, greed, the tobacco and so forth. Tobacco certainly shapes that culture, but the Anglican Church also shapes that culture. And the Anglican Church, in the colonies at least, was fairly Calvinistic.
Mm-hmm.
We normally associate the Calvinists with Presbyterians and Congregationalists in the Middle Colonies and New England. So I would tend to largely agree. Now, as a historian, I guess my issue with the way this sort of ethos argument that you're making, right? There is this sort of, Calvinist kind of Christian ethos that's individualistic and democratic. It's embedded in the polity, if you will, of Congregationalism and Quakerism. I would argue two ways, sort of against, maybe not totally against what you're saying, but I would question two things. One, certainly in New England, you have a very, very democratic, sort of individualistic, congregationalist kind of ethos. There is no sort of hierarchical church structure within New England. Each individual town and community has their own churches. They make their own decisions about who their minister is going to be. I guess I see the Middle Colonies and the South perhaps a little more hierarchical in terms of their religious denominational structure.
Right.
You mentioned the Quakers. Granted, yes, the Quakers are radically individualistic in terms of their belief in the inner light, right? Their belief that there's nothing that mediate, there's no mediator between the voice of God and themselves. But yet, if you also look at the structure of the Society of Friends in the Middle Colonies, it's very hierarchical. There's a great deal of order there and control over just how radical and individualistic people can be and still be a member of the community.
Right.
Same thing with the church and the Anglican churches in the South, in a sort of a different way. Now the other, and I really welcome a sort of conversation here about this. As a historian too, my reaction to these, and I've heard these sort of ethos arguments before, and I think there's a lot of credibility to them in terms of the sort of general culture. I'm always looking for those links, the smoking gun, so to speak. And like I said, I haven't read your book, so maybe you do provide the sort of documentation. I'm looking for the sort of less abstract sort of links between, say, the First Great Awakening and the American Revolution, or congregational religion and the Founding Fathers' words and ideas as they play out in the documents. I'm curious, can we make any of those links?
Well, can we
make any of those direct connections between congregational polity or the enthusiasm and democratic spirit of the First Great Awakening, for example, and the ideas about liberty and so forth of the founders?
I think that is a really good question, and I want to, since you haven't read my book, I'll kind of give
sure.
you a little bit of backfill on that.
Yeah.
I'm not generally a history of ideas guy. I'm
yeah.
more from an interest-based perspective, and my book, The Political Origins of Religious Liberty, I put the emphasis on that word political there,
right.
and I explain the our origins of the First Amendment in the United States, and I also cover Latin America and Russia in the book. But I talk about the First Amendment there as largely coming about from interest-based types of
right.
It's an interest-based argument, essentially,
mm-hmm.
wherein the need to have free trade among colonies meant that you had to grant the Quakers the right of passage through Massachusetts. It's bad for business if you
right.
constantly arrest somebody, a trader from a different religion,
right.
and by trader as trader, not traitor.
Yeah.
And as well as a few other things, during the time of the Revolutionary War, it was necessary to really come together as a nation. Ben Franklin's famous cartoon or picture, "Unite or Die," and say let's put away our religious differences here. But it's so much so that the colonist in right around that time, in order to woo over the French, really turned on a dime toward their Catholic
right.
neighbors. They said, well, we really hate those Papists.
Yeah.
And then they say, well, we need the French and they're Catholic.
Yeah.
Oh, we love those guys. Catholics, come on in.
Right.
So I see it as much more in an interest-based, but I get usually criticized for that in a lot of my work. You really downplay the role of ideas.
Right.
I do have a two- or three-page part of my book where I said, yeah, I believe ideas are important, but I want to hold those aside. Now, what you say is looking for that smoking gun, and I think this is a point that we might share here, is that, and maybe I'm coming from it at a slightly different direction, but really proving that smoking gun with ideas is much more difficult than I think with interests.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Well, what does this look like? Can you give me an example of a way in which you connect your sort of Congregationalists or your Great Awakening Evangelicals based on interest to the founding?
Yeah, again, not being an ideational person, again,
right.
this is something that I have this general academic sense of.
Yeah.
But, the fact that the people involved in the process
yeah.
were devoutly religious and they were bringing those views there. Now, one of the things, and I do think a lot of people who plant their hat on the Christian nationalism argument really try to say that there's this direct representation that, you picked up the Bible and then 5 minutes later you're writing the Constitution.
Right.
But, that's, in terms of how ideas play out there, no, that's not how it works, is that you get your ideas. You've been inculcated or socialized
yeah.
in these yeah. ideas for your life, 20,
yeah.
40, 50 years, and they're just kind of there in the background. And in terms of this, I think of you know, during the colonial times, especially in the New England area, you have the idea of covenantal government.
Sure.
You have covenants and say, well, you know, this is kind of how we do things, right?
Yeah.
Local control. Yeah, let's kind of put that into the Constitution, or the idea of the people having certain rights in towns and things like that. So, you know, I can't make that direct connection where somebody picked up one passage of the Bible and said, let's write this in the Constitution. And I think it would be very difficult for any historian to do that. But
I tend to agree with you to an extent. I think there is this culture. There is this kind of, whatever, these ideas are sort of socially constructed or culturally constructed through generations of living in Puritan New England, for example. I guess my, I would say perhaps, you know, I mean, there's always the, you know, perhaps that influenced it. You know, as a historian, I'm much more interested in the smoking gun, and it may just be a different approach to our disciplinary approach here. I'm not sure. But I would challenge you to think a little bit about, the fact that much of the sort of argument that you seem to be making is a sort of, you know, the American Revolution was a sort of New England writ large.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not entirely convinced that. Now, granted, I will give you the individualistic, egalitarian, democratic, Congregationalist, covenanted community, so forth, argument for New England. I'm not sure, as a historian of early America, that I see that as strongly within the middle colonies and the South.
Right.
And that's, you know, that may be a point of difference.
Yeah. And again, you know, I'm not saying that this was 100% influence going in there, that there were definitely, you know, different ideas. In fact, you know, as we come to the issue of freedom of religion and such, one of the things I found in writing my book is that some of the people that spoke bravely for liberty were also in favor of an established church, which
sure.
is kind of, an interesting historical note that I came across. I guess one way to look at it, too, would be to put it in a bit of a comparative perspective, since my teeth were essentially cut in Latin American politics.
Okay.
And, you know, I think about Catholicism having a huge influence in the way that the Latin American colonies were constructed. And when they came out of their independence period, again, there a lot of them drafted constitutions that mimic what the United States did. But it really was much heavier. It wasn't so much on the local control. It was much more heavy, top-down, hierarchical in its nature. And, you know, again, there's a variety of different arguments you could
They have reflected the Catholic culture.
Again, it's not a one-to-one relationship, but certainly that, as I called it, background radiation tends to be there. Well, let's go ahead and flesh this out. And you divide up the history that you're talking about into basically three separate segments. The British colonies, so we're talking roughly Jamestown, 1607, through right before the Revolution. You have that revolutionary era, which, you know, is everybody associates 1776, the Declaration of Independence, but you carry that into the 1760s as well. And then the writing of the Constitution in that constitutional period, which probably could include the Articles of Confederation in there as well. So let's go ahead and work through those three periods and start out with the colonial period. And, and I'll ask the same question that you ask in the chapter of your book. Were the British colonies Christian societies?
Yeah. Again, I hate to keep going back to this, but it depends on how you define that term.
Right.
Now certainly, we just got done talking a little bit about New England. I mean, I think any historian, worth his or her salt would have to admit that, you know, Massachusetts Bay, Plymouth, you know, these colonies, even Connecticut to an extent, these colonies were designed to be Christian, Calvinist, Puritan, whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
Societies. I mean, you can't argue with that fact in terms of the vision. A very narrow vision of Christianity, I would say, but the vision here was to create a unique sort of city on a hill, a unique kind of colony. Moving farther south, when you get to the middle colonies, for example, Certainly, Christianity, along with economic motivations, but Christianity is an important part. The Quakers are really trying to establish in those early years of Pennsylvania some kind of Christian Quaker, if you will, moral kind of order to their society. And you could make the same argument for the Anglicans in the South, although, you know, in Virginia and the Carolinas, although I would probably say they were not as successful in sort of permeating the dominant economic-driven ethos of the place. But certainly, these colonies, if you define it based upon the vision or the documents, you know, what they were trying to accomplish there, you know, you could say all of them, in some degree, were founded on based on Christian principles, or they were Christian colonies.
Well, one of the things about the Southern colonies, and this is a point I agree with you on here, is that the Anglican Church coming over into the Southern colonies wasn't as deeply embedded as the Congregationalists in New England, in part because, I mean, again, that context is really important. You talk about that at the beginning of your book, and I like to do this when I read history, is to put myself in the shoes of folks. Right. I mean, if you were an Anglican minister in the late 1600s, I mean, you would probably not want to go over to the New World or to the Americas, because, you know, that kind of was a sucky outpost.
Yeah.
Right? If you're in you're in the Anglican Church, the Church of England, you want to work your way up in hierarchy. London is the place to be.
Yeah.
Right? So this, you know, in terms of the ministers going over there, they might not have the most ardent ones, or the ones that come over have mixed motives. They say, well, yeah, I'm a minister, but, oh, I could get a big farm out there? Okay, I think I'll go, right?
So. No, I think you're exactly right. I think a lot of these Anglican ministers are driven by sort of self-interested, if you want to call them that motives. And, you know, just the nature of Virginia being so driven by tobacco and so driven by mercantilism and these economic factors, Even the serious Anglicans, if you want to say that, the devout Anglicans, and you know, it's hard to judge on who was the devout and who was not, but you know, some of these men that were serious about sort of bringing a deeper sense of Christian culture to the Jamestown, just really were not able to overcome the sort of dominant economic flavor, if you will, of the place. Now back to your original question. You know, if you were to define Christianity in terms of orthopraxy, now here's where you would need to sort of have some kind of sort of understanding of Christianity that transcends sort of the historical moment, right? This is not necessarily a historical way of doing this, but, you know, if you were to take sort of certain doctrines or certain teachings of the New Testament and apply them to life in the colonies, you know, you may find them coming up short. For example, you know, the colonial Indian relations in most of the colonies, Pennsylvania being at least for a time perhaps a small exception here, but, you know, Indian colony relations, you know, there is something in the New Testament about loving one's neighbor and these kinds of things. Certainly, the attempts to, remove the Indians or drive them out of the land, you know, I don't know. You know, we could debate this. I'm not a theologian or a minister, but, you know, we could debate whether or not this was Christian behavior, the institution of slavery, right? All of these kinds of things. You know, that were not sort of necessarily Christian way, you know, new Christian ways of behaving. You know, does a Christian society in, say, New England, for example, hang Quakers, you know, kill the capital punishment for Quakers for simply disagreeing with them? I mean, there's not a lot of religious liberty in these places. You know, does a Christian society throw out one of its most talented ministers, and I'm thinking here of Roger Williams, you know, or because of theological disagreements. So, you know, again, that's in some ways taking our sort of modern-day understandings of what Christianity is and applying that to the colonies.
That's a good point there. And I you know, in reading your book, and when you mentioned that the issue of orthopraxy, of how we're measuring up,
right,
how these colonies measured up according to the scriptures, I mean, that's a tough one because as I sat down here and I said, man, you know, if I apply these same standards to myself, you know, I go to church and I consider myself a Christian. But, you know, if I put those orthopraxy standards on me, you know, loving my neighbor, I kind of get upset when, you know, the neighbor's dog poops on the yard and stuff like that. You know, it's I have my moments. So I wouldn't be able to really consider myself as a Christian then. And I mean, even if you think of the Catholic Church after Vatican Council II really coming out in favor of religious liberty. But in Latin America, man, they were shutting down Protestants left and right in a non-neighborly kind of way. Right. Well, then the Catholic Church doesn't count as Christian. Yeah. And are we setting standards a little bit high for getting context and perhaps making the perfect the enemy of the good?
Yeah, I think there's a danger in that. And I may slip into that danger at times in the book. You know, as opposed to the sort of true historian's task, right, would be to say, well, the Puritans in New England believed that what they were doing was Christian. You know, hey, these people, you know, let's try to empathize a little bit and use this kind of historical discipline or virtue of, you know, empathy and walking in one's shoes, as you mentioned before, right?
Right.
Hey, there are people running around in the town of Salem who are agents of Satan, right? Witches.
Right.
You know, if we believe that, and, you know, if you believe that, you know, you're trying to create a Christian commonwealth and there's agents of the devil in your community, you know, you may want to try to kill them or hang them. And you may see that as a deeply Christian act, much like, say, a Catholic exorcism or, you know, something similar. You know, if you want to create a very pure colony based upon what you believe are the teachings of Scripture, and someone like Roger Williams or Anne Hutchinson or Mary Dyer, the Quaker, you know, that I mentioned before, does not conform to that, then you have to do the, you know, for them, the godly thing and remove them. So I think, you know, that's a fair point that you make about, you know, what kind of, you know, how much do we look at these, how much did they understand these things as these places as Christian communities and societies and colonies, and how much do we sort of superimpose our understanding of Christianity upon them?
Yeah, even, let me ask you this too, even in the context of the day and imposing a little bit of our standards on them, because I, you know, my own book too, I'm critical of the standards of religious liberty that the Puritans imposed on, you know, Anne Hutchinson and Mary Dyer.
Right.
But even in the context of the day with our standards helping to inform our decision a little bit, wasn't it a little bit better than pretty much everywhere else in the world? I mean, were they sowing the seeds for liberty, you know, sowing the seeds for religious liberty or sowing the seeds for a more democratic and open society at the time?
Well, you know, that's the sort of great paradox. We're talking here specifically about New England. In some ways, that's the great paradox, right? Of the whole New England experiment. And sometimes I don't, you know, as a historian, sometimes I just kind of, you know, sort of rest on that sort of paradox and say, you know, it's just, we're never going to figure it out. But, you know, you clearly have a group of Puritans who come over for religious freedom, for religious liberty, you know, to fleeing from the tyrannical Anglican, at least as they understand it, the tyranny of the Anglican Church. Archbishop Laud and so forth, and then you have a society that is largely intolerant to everybody else, right? Mm-hmm. So it's I always tell my students, you know, in Puritan New England, you were certainly religiously free. You were religiously free to conform yourself to orthodoxy.
Yeah, the cost of not making the right choice were pretty high, but you're free to do that, right?
Right,
yeah.
Right. And then, you know, but the other point, and this sort of popped into my head as you were talking, you know, back to this whole question of sort of superimposing one's sort of modern day or, you know, superimposing our Christian standards on the past. You do have to remember that there were people living in Puritan New England, like Hutchinson, like Roger Williams, who were arguing that their view of religious liberty was too restricting, if it was religious liberty at all. So you have this great defender of religious liberty in Roger Williams, who was critiquing Puritans for being non-Christian or not entirely Christian in their understanding of people who differed from them. So it's not just us sort of coming in and saying, well, they don't measure up to whatever our understanding of Christianity was. There were people at the time who were making similar critiques.
Yeah, and that's where I'm kind of coming from when I say they were sowing the seeds of this, is that it was an environment that allowed the Roger Williams and the William Penns to say, you know, you came to get rid of the tyranny of the Anglican Church, but aren't you kind of doing that again? What if we just kind of opened it? And also holding them to their own standard of, you know, their own Calvinistic standard that say you really have to reach a, a personal relationship with God. You have to be free to do that, right?
Yeah. Well, these, I mean, people like William Penn and Roger Williams, I think, are much more consistently Protestant than the Puritans are. You know, in the sense that they understand the sort of liberty-driven dimensions of Protestantism, right? You know, put the Bible in the hands of the people, let them interpret it for themselves, you know, translate it into the vernacular, if you were to go back to Luther and others, and give them the liberty and the freedom. So the Puritans trying to create this very Calvinist Protestant society, which upholds this idea of individual interpretation of the scriptures as opposed to the Catholic hierarchy teaching, you know, telling you what to believe. It's really the ones who are removed from that colony or the ones who go down to Pennsylvania, like the Quakers and William Penn, who most represent this kind of Protestant liberty that's many of the reformers promoted.
Yeah. And again, you know, this is part of the background radiation of this thing. I think the Roger Williams are revered as heroes in our national conscience.
Yeah, and here's the way this affects the way the current debates go. I mean, what bothers me the most is when I hear Christian nationalists sort of saying, you know, well, let's look at the, you know, Massachusetts Bay was founded as a Christian nation, a Christian society, or the Mayflower, and, you know, all these kinds of things, when it was actually those who were removed from those colonies who actually are the ones we you know, who best reflect the America that's going to come, say, after 1776.
Yeah, it's, you know, the indirect effects that I was talking about before. It wasn't a, you know, we plant our flag in this hereby as a Christian nation, even though, you know, one could say, well, yeah, they kind of came with the Bible in hand. But, yeah, it works its way out. History has a way of, you know, changing things, as you note in your book. Let's go ahead and turn to the era of the Revolutionary War. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, this encompasses not just the 1775 through the end of the war, but going back to the 1760s or so. And you write on page 120 of your book, Christians today who want to argue that the Revolutionary War was just must offer concrete evidence to suggest that this was indeed a last resort. Explain what you meant by that and why was that necessary for establishing the idea of a Christian nation?
Well, when I talk about last resort, I'm making a reference here to sort of classic just war theory. And for those of your listeners who may not be familiar with it, I mean, I define that as, with basically four quick points. The just war theory as put forth by the likes of Aquinas and Augustine and so forth, some of those Catholic thinkers who formulated these ideas, basically affirms that government is something that comes from God, it's ordained of God, and it's the purpose of government is to preserve peace and to promote justice. And then second, I think the just war tradition suggests that war should be avoided whenever possible. But at times, you know, war is necessary in order to bring about peace. And then third, the just war tradition suggests that war must be declared by a government that's legitimate. There must be a set goal for a war, and that goal should be, again, the restoration of peace. And then finally, a just war protects civilians or protects non-combatants. Now, what I find striking as I read through the founding fathers, but also the ministers of the day, is that this classic just war theory you know, is never employed by the revolutionaries. There's some varieties of it, but very few of actually none of them actually appeal to Aquinas or Augustus, or even appeal to this sort of classic tradition of just war theory.
Let me ask about that.
Yeah.
And again, setting it back into the context of everything. Again, these are Calvinistic Puritans, to a large part, you know, in the northern colonies and such. And not surprisingly, they didn't have the best relations with Catholics. And
yeah.
One could easily think, well, that Aquinas guy, and
yeah.
he was kind of a Catholic thinker,
sure.
Right? I mean, is that
no,
possibly?
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I think the point that I'm making is they just didn't employ it.
Yeah, didn't.
They just didn't use it. I mean, there are some signs of just war theory in Augustine, and, there were Calvinists in the 18th century. Not many, though, who actually did read some Augustine.
I'm just kind of wondering. I don't know if you know this or not, but did Calvin ever have a just war theory? You ever deal with
that?
You
know, I don't think he addressed it in those terms, but
yeah.
I'm no expert
okay.
on the subject.
Yeah.
Yeah. So back to to the question of was it a just war? In some ways, you need to take out that whole classical dimension of Aquinas, Augustine. That's sort of off the table. I think you're suggesting this, too. I mean, not many people are engaging with that. What they are doing in a sort of good Protestant fashion is making appeals to the Bible, as to whether or not the war is just or not. And you really get a lot of literature, especially sermons and public addresses by clergymen, making arguments. Now, I find that a lot of the loyalists, the Anglicans, are tend to be the biblical literalists, in this debate. So they're appealing to Romans chapter 13, for example, which talks about subordinating oneself to government. Government is ordained by God. There's even a passage in Romans chapter 13 that talks about obeying, or I should say, paying your tribute. Or your taxes, the patriots come back and they say, well, that doesn't apply to a tyrannical government. And then, the loyalists come back and say, well, where was St. Paul writing these things? He was in the Roman Empire, which was not particularly friendly to Christians. So this is the arguments that they make. Fear God, honor the king in 1 Peter 2, it talks about this. So what's fascinating is they tend to be literal. The patriots on this point tend to, take much greater liberty, if you will, with the text and tend to, interpret the text in more metaphorical ways or in ways that don't necessarily conform very well to the literalism of the loyalists. So it's a really interesting debate that takes place here. And when I say then Christians today want to argue that the Revolutionary War was just, must offer concrete evidence to suggest this was indeed a last resort, I think it's an interesting, I don't know if I have a definitive answer to whether or not it was a just war or not, because we can debate, is a war over high taxes, for example, just? Is a war over, the removal of certain liberties, like after the coercive acts of 1774, when they take away trial by jury, they close Boston Harbor, they close down the town meetings and so forth, thus taking away these deeply held British liberties that the colonists had. Is that something that is that merits a sort of armed conflict, or is that a last resort? So these are tough sort of theological questions, which are a little bit outside of my area of sort of expertise. But what I try to do is at least try to play out or analyze them in the ways in which this debate occurred at the time.
Yeah, it's interesting you brought up the Roman 13s, and as I was reading through this in your book as well, I thought about the Calvinists, and again, I'm going back to the Calvinist thinking, and that probably didn't resonate with them very well, because I'm thinking about their European experience.
Yeah.
Or if they read Romans 13, it says, honor the king, and or the First Peter, honor the king.
Yeah,
and they're looking at, hey, the king of France is really beating the crap out of us right now. Right. And this kind of stinks.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, just from their tradition, and it is interesting. I mean, it's how we use, you know, biblical passages for, in many ways, some of our own self-interested readings. Yeah. The loyalists say, yeah, don't forget to honor the king, folks. You need to be, you know, biblical when you pick up that Bible and call us to arms to against right. the George and stuff. But yeah, I think that is somewhat interesting. Let me, I want to ask you kind of a interesting personal question, because you're a historian, and when I do history, I often like to put myself in the shoes of the, right. the characters there. If you were in that at that time, would you have picked up arms?
Oh, wow, that's a tough one to answer. But you know, I'm not sure I necessarily would. I often explore this idea with my students.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I may have found myself in the 2/3 of the population that maybe, you know, I tend to naturally lean perhaps a little more conservative. So who knows? I may have probably leaned towards either some kind of neutral position or some kind of modified Toryism.
Yeah. I think your students then will appreciate that me asking this question, since you ask it to them.
Yeah, yeah.
Fair play, I guess. The actually, in reading through that chapter as well, I kept thinking of the movie The Patriot.
Right.
Right, where you have Mel Gibson's character over time, you know, he was, no, I don't want to do this war thing again. I've experienced it in the French and Indian War. This is a bad thing.
Yeah.
And over time, you see this transformation of him. And it had those religious yeah. undertones to it, which I think is kind of interesting.
Right. You're right.
Let's go ahead and move next to the Declaration of Independence.
Sure.
And this is a big one. And as you know, to set this up in comparative perspective to the Constitution, you have two different chapters on this.
Right.
The Declaration, there's some God talk in that one.
Absolutely.
In the Constitution, not so much.
Yeah.
So you, not surprisingly, a lot of Christian nationalists go along the route by holding up the Declaration of Independence and saying,
right.
hey, look at this. There's nature's gods in there, and
yeah.
that's God, 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 right? And
yeah.
At least four, five times it's
yeah.
mentioned in there. You make an interesting argument in here, and this had never really occurred to me, and I think it's a very good point, that you say that the Declaration of Independence was a foreign policy document.
Yeah.
And so talk about what you meant by that and
yeah.
how the whole God talk works
yeah.
into that.
Well, this is an argument that I'm actually borrowing from a historian of the Constitution named David Armitage, who in his recent book on the Declaration of Independence actually went so far as to suggest that not only the God language, which is really not an important part of his work, but even the language about natural rights and life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and so forth, these were sort of British ideas that were, you know, would not have been surprising to anyone who read the Declaration of Independence. Oftentimes there is this sense in which these ideas of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness or property and so forth are uniquely kind of American ideas that Thomas Jefferson and the committee who wrote the Declaration of Independence came up with, on their own. What Armitage argues, and I think it's rather convincing, is that the Declaration of Independence was never meant to be a statement of American ideals, values, whether it relates to God, natural rights, or whatever. It was, again, really designed to tell the rest of the world that we are indeed free, the colonies are indeed free and independent states. And it's really, the primary purpose is to literally that, declare independence, in the hopes that, you know, the French, the Russians, the Spanish, and so forth might come now to their aid and support them in the conflict with England.
Let me stop you right there, because that's interesting, and that struck a tone with me too in reading of that. Because again, I thought looking at the Declaration as a foreign policy statement,
right.
I think is a really neat lens to view this from, and in many ways, I think it's very correct that this is, hey, world, we're a different nation now, so you have to deal with us differently. And I think your point as well, that these ideas that were stated in there, life, liberty, and happiness, were not just popping out of thin air in 1776. Right. I mean, you take a look at British history, it's really the slow and bumpy and sometimes violent progression toward these things dating back to the Magna Carta through the, you know, Glorious Revolution.
Well, certainly 1688, if not all the way back to the Magna Carta.
Yeah, and so I buy that. But when you say that this is a declaration to the rest of the world and that language was included in there, I would argue more that it's a declaration to Britain using their own words against them rather than the French. Because the French at that time, that was Louis the 16th. He looks at this pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness. Right, he's like, I'm all for that in the Hall of Mirrors here. But, you know, my peasants, no.
Right. So, I think you can make that argument, certainly. Certainly there's sort of multiple sort of purposes here that work simultaneously. So, I would think that, you know, this is very British language. I mean, in some ways, I often tell my students, the Declaration of Independence, at least the first several paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence, are sort of the pinnacle of the sort of British political philosophy that these colonists have imbibed. These are the British ideas of liberty that have prevailed. You know, Britain is not France. Britain is not Russia. Britain is not absolute monarch. It's a limited government, and thus the people are afforded certain liberties and rights. And the whole revolution, at least as I see it, is, hey, we're doing, you know, you in England are no longer being British. You're no longer being English. And we're defending the rights that you taught us to have. Now the God stuff in there certainly is something to be acknowledged, and I think you see a progression. I think the Declaration of Independence is not a Christian document in the sense that the God that's being discussed in the document is not a God who incarnated himself in human flesh, died for the sins of the world, was resurrected again on the third day, and so forth. But you do see a God that I think progressively, if you look at the references to God, and I don't know if this was the intent of Jefferson or the committee, but if you look at the progression of the references to God, the four references to God, you learn a little bit more about this God as you move forward. You start off with a sort of very vague kind of God of nature. Then, by the end, you're talking about a God, or then you get into this God also creates, right, the creator. And then by the end, in the last paragraph, you have a God who is a supreme judge and a God who is providential. And to me, providence suggests a God who actually intervenes at times, perhaps, in the lives of human beings and in the lives of human affairs.
Right.
So it's certainly a theistic God, T-H-E-I-S-T-I-K, theistic God, or I should say theistic God. It's you'd be hard pressed to say it doesn't have to be a Christian God, although certainly Christians would embrace a theistic God.
Yeah. What about the in terms of this? You know, people oftentimes focus a great deal on Jefferson's meaning on this, and I'm sure you know Jefferson. You make some very good arguments in the book, and other people have that he's a deist. And I buy that he has a much more amorphous view of God as compared to Michelangelo's, finger pointing God with lightning bolts and such.
Yeah.
But again, Jefferson is writing to a culture, and this culture is going to understand when he says nature's God. He's not talking Gaia or he might be. But the culture at large, when they hear nature's God, they're hearing something. Yeah, that's the God of nature who made these rocks right in front of me and who is going to smite these rocks on my head if I don't work the way that God wants to. So how do you balance that if you need to at all?
Well, I think you can make that argument and still not say that, you know, it's a sort of uniquely kind of Christian document. Certainly this is the God of the sort of Abrahamic religions. It's the Judeo-Christian God. It is a God that is a God that is recognized by people in this largely Christian culture.
Yeah, but why would they have to make it an explicit Christian God? Because everybody pretty much there was Christian, so you know they're not saying this is the Christian God. This is not Yahweh or Allah or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why. You know, you could ask the flip. flip side of the question too. I mean, you know, why wouldn't they identify, if they wanted to be a specifically Christian God, why didn't they identify that? But I see your argument. You're saying, well, the culture makes, you know, it's unnecessary, sort of in this kind of culture. It just seems to me that if they wanted this to be a distinctly Christian God in the Declaration of Independence, they would have, in some ways, at least said so, or referenced Jesus Christ, or, you know, made it more explicit. But I, your arguments, you make a good point. This is your back to your sort of culture argument, right? The dominant culture just sort of assumes things, and you know, you could be right about that. Again, this is maybe the difference in the way we're approaching this. You know, I'm looking for the hard evidence, and you're making a sort of more. I don't know. I hope it's fair to call it a sort of abstract. Argument.
Well, I'm you know, definitely thinking about the indirect influences, and you know what the, you know, to use your own term, what the context of the time happens to be. And again, going back to my perspective on this, I'm not a Christian nationalist saying that the United States was explicitly Christian nationalist, but a lot of influences were there.
Now, if
the Christian nationalists like to hang their hat on the Declaration of Independence, the other side of this debate in contemporary times really likes to point to the Constitution in the opposite direction. They say, well, you know, there's no God in the Constitution. Maybe at the very end you can make a case, they say, signed in the year of the Lord, 1787, but that you might as well just put AD or something of that nature. You know, from my vantage point, I'm a political economist by nature, and for me, the point of a constitution, not just the Constitution of the United States, but any constitution, is basically to lay out the rules of the game, right? It's one, who's in charge, how do those people who are in charge get picked, and how are the rules that come from those people get chosen and made? And for me, the genius of the U.S. Constitution is that it accomplished these goals with the utmost simplicity. I mean, you compare this to the telephone book size EU constitution they have today. You know, ours is pretty much a page or two, depending on how you print it out in font size. And so the question comes up, well, is this a Christian document? My question almost is, does it need to be?
Yeah.
So where are your thoughts there?
No, I'm often puzzled by those who claim it's a Christian document, not only A, because it says nothing about Christianity, but for the point you're making here, B, you know, back to my argument about the Declaration of Independence, you know, the original intent of the Declaration of Independence, I argue, is a foreign policy document. The original purpose of the Constitution, if you want to throw out that term, original intent, which can get us into all kinds of sticky situations. But you know, it's clearly, you're right. It's a form of government. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't really speak to you know, it's not designed to speak to whether or not America's a Christian nation or not. Now, you know, I tend to be sympathetic in the book to the sort of small f, if you will, federalist argument, which basically leaves you know, the Christian or the religious issues up to the states. I think you see in the 10th Amendment. Where basically the Constitution, you know, the amendment says, you know, anything that the Constitution does not necessarily or does not explicitly talk about will be left up to the states. So, you know, if you look at the United States Constitution, you have Article 6, which talks about the fact that there will be no qualifications for office, right? But if you look at all the state constitutions, with the exception of Virginia, all of them have religious qualifications for office, a Christian, if not Protestant, qualifications for office.
Right.
So this gets back then, coming full circle here, this gets back to sort of how we're defining Christian nation. Now, I try to make the argument in the book that, you know, there's certainly no sense of nationalism that exists in America in the decade or so after the American Revolution. There is no sort of common sense of unity in the country. The Articles of Confederation are very much, you know, individual states with a very, very weak central government, if you could even call it that. Now, if you want to call the United States a nation in the first part of the 1780s, then it you know, it's a nation that is basically more of a confederacy. It's driven by states. It's driven by their own local interests. And as a result, then, it looks pretty darn Christian to me, because in all of those states, again, Virginia being a big exception, they want Christian leaders, they want Christian people running the government, and so forth. So if you were to define nation there, certainly in the 1780s under the Articles of Confederation, you know, we look like a Christian country, at least in terms of adding up all of the different local parts of that country, which all uphold Christianity.
That's a really good point to mention as well, because when we think about the word nation and nationalism, you know, certainly there was a lot of unite or die rallying around the Declaration of Independence, around the call to arms that occurred during the Revolutionary War era. But yeah, once the war finishes up, you know, it states. People identified who they are by their state. And there are these centripetal forces pushing everybody in outward directions, which, again, as you mentioned, the Article of Confederation, you know, leads to a lot of chaos. And they have to go back and say, well, maybe this is not working too well. Let's try to bring this back with some...
Well, even then, I mean, you know, there's a famous article by the Princeton historian John Murren, who talks about the Constitution being a roof without walls. In other words, even then, the Constitution creates this sort of national document or this umbrella document. But it's really going to take, you know, another 50, 60 years up through the Civil War, 70 years, before we really get a full understanding of what the United States of America is. And I would argue America doesn't really get a strong sense of nationalism in the way we know it today until after the Civil War. I mean, there's signs of it, say, in the War of 1812, you get a certain sense of nationalistic fervor in the country, the Second American Revolution, and so forth. But the kind of nationalism that we celebrate today, whether it be through the, you know, World War, victories in wars, or the Olympics, or patriotism, you know, or 4th of July celebrations, really is not something that has a strong sort of unifying component until after the Civil War, when the Union sort of triumphs over the Confederacy.
And I'd probably say till far after that, too, almost to the World War One, maybe even, because people still identified with their state, and there's still a lot of the, you know, resentment in the South after the Civil War that, you know, in many ways lingers till today. I think we're out of time here, and I wish we could go on and talk about this more, because it is an absolutely fascinating book, and I urge people to pick it up, because, you know, I think as one of the book blurbs on the back says, that you know, nobody's going to be satisfied with this book, because it cuts across, you know, every type of ideological line, and I really think that's true. And that's a good thing, because it gets you really thinking about your own perspectives. You can put your finger somewhere and say, oh yeah, I see that, but oh, wait a minute, he's saying something different there. And that's, I think, really the hallmark of a great academic book. So I urge our folks to visit our website to find the link to it, or you can just go directly to one of the booksellers online and pick it up. It's Was America Founded as a Christian Nation? In the last minute or two, I want to give you the opportunity to, you know, speculate. And this is one of the things I like to do with all my guests about, you know, what does this really matter for today? And that, I think, in part is in your book, not only in the first couple chapters when you cover the history of this idea, but in your concluding chapters. Is this just something that is intellectual argument for the sake of argument, or does it really matter?
Yeah, I mean, as a historian, and when I think about the past and how the past is useful to us today, in this case, particularly the history of the American founding, I mean, the past, the study of the past really cuts both ways, or to use a different metaphor, you know, it's two sides of the coin. One side, clearly the past informs who we are today. It forms our nation, informs our culture, informs our understanding of church and state in this particular case. And certainly we can draw upon certain basic principles that the founders laid forth, you know, to help us understand our debates today. So I would encourage people to study the past, to examine you know, the founding fathers and the documents, and see what kind of ideals and values the United States is sort of rooted in and based upon, and found, you know, these foundational principles. The other side of the coin is that the past is often, as we like historians like to say, a foreign country. You know, and it's very different. I mean, in some ways, these founders living over 200 years ago lived in a world that was very, very different than the one in which we live in today. And we need to be careful when we go into the past and try to find something useful for us in the present. We need to remember that, you know, this was a world that was overwhelmingly Christian. You know, there were no Hindus and Muslims, and you know, it was a very religiously homogeneous, to some extent, world that they lived in. So, you know, it's hard to suggest that we have to rely on the founders completely for everything when we think about, you know, whether or not we are a Christian nation or not today, or how to deal with people who are not Christians who live in our society. So I think we always have to hold those two things in tension, the sort of foreignness of the past, but also the relevance of the past, and navigate those two things. So does the question of whether America was founded as a Christian nation, is that important? Absolutely it is. It's something we should debate, hopefully civilly, in the public arena, in the public square, and so forth. But we need to do it in an informed, nuanced, complex way, realizing that these people lived 200 years ago and may not necessarily, be engaging in the same kind of culture we live in today.
I think that is a great thought to leave with. And again, I share the same convictions as you, and I love studying the past. And so our guest today has been John Fea. And John, it's been a pleasure having you on Research on Religion.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Tony. It was fun.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.